And DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by the Reverend Claire Jaques. And meanwhile, here on BBC Radio 4 FM, we continue with our Book of the Week. Dublin Back is author Linda Cracknell's account of walking in the footsteps of others. In today's episode, In His Footsteps, Linda makes a very personal ascent in the Alps. The reader is Teresa Gallagher.
I have no memory of my father. He died of cancer in 1961. Although he was a keen mountaineer, I knew little of what and where he climbed. I had no scent or record of his adventures. I started asking questions, and I acquired a photo. Summer 1952 in the Swiss Alps. A young man, slim and fit, stands with hands on hips in front of a pine tree. He has a cravat around his neck and a face that, although shaded by a squint-brimmed hat, hints at features like my own. He looked so alive here with his hemp rope, canvas rucksack, wearing a grin. Yet 8.5 years later, he was dead. I began to wonder if I could identify one of his journeys and walk a memorial to him. When I asked for specifics of mountains or routes, it was only Finsteraarhorn that could still be named. My mother pointed at its daunting profile in a brown leather album. At 25 years old, half my age, my father led his own expedition here. If I was to answer the call to follow him, I reasoned to myself, I had to start my alpine climbing career before I reached 50. I thought at first it would mean joining a commercial expedition, something I always resist. But when I talked about it to Rick, an old friend who I've walked and skied with in Scotland, he and Colin agreed to absorb me into a trip of their own, bravely, considering my inexperience in the Alps. The time had come to discover his mountains. Finsteraarhorn, Bernese Oberland, Switzerland. A single electronic note by my ear stands me upright by my bunk at 3:45 a.m. A glance through the window of the Finsteraarhorn hut reveals a miracle. Stars. A sky full of them. Colin has told us the rule his father had in the Alps. If you can see 5 stars, you go for it. There's no discussion. By 4:45, we're jolting our bodies into life with a scramble up the steep rocks behind the hut. My lungs feel pinched by 3,000 metres of altitude and by my pack pressing from behind. As ever, it's heavier than it should be. At the boundary between rock and snow, we put on crampons and rope up for the snowfield ahead. After the fumblings and uncertainties of the previous week, when we were acclimatising and practising all this on climbs in the Arola area, the tying of the knot is now almost automatic, oddly comforting. A cry goes up from Rick as first sun pricks pink the Fischerhorn and Grünhorn peaks. We move off slowly. Colin leads, finding a line towards a rib of rock that descends from the summit. I follow, always between the other two, taking least responsibility. In preparation for this trip, I wrote to the Alpine Club, believing my father to have been a member. They were able to help with the first part of the trip. My father went, like us, to Arola. He was with a party from the Oxford University Mountaineering Club, OUMC, climbing in the ranges that spike up from Val d'Aron. Dick, his fellow climbers called him. I imagine him as the life and soul of the party at the Arola campsite, and at the Hotel Colon where they drank local wine and ate raclette at a birthday celebration. As I read the joyous words of adventure recorded in the OUMC journal, Richard Cracknell, the summit hunter, began to materialise. The club had no record of the trip to the Bernese Oberland the following week. It was clearly an informal arrangement with 2 other club members, Jim Parry and David Lawton. They were also joined by Effie Pendleton, another Oxford student, who was the fiancée of David. In a photo my father took, the three, Jim, Effie and David, are blurred in black and white, paused with backs to the camera. They stare ahead, away from him. Finsteraarhorn peaks high in the furthest eastern distance, and I imagine that's what they're focusing on. I like the look of Effie from the photo. A compact body that looks strong, balanced. A high bounce of short dark hair. And under her goggles, an easy smile. She looks comfortable in this environment, ready for adventure. We climb towards the rocky ridge that holds the Frühstückplatz, or breakfast place. A wide snow bridge is directly ahead of us, dipping slightly between two open mouths. Aware of the tricksy appearance of this new snow, we creep towards it a few steps at a time, as if approaching a dangerous animal that might suddenly charge us. Colin coils slack rope in his hand, while behind him Rick and I stand firm, ice axe picks turned outwards, ready to brace on the ground should the surface fail him. Then he's down on all fours, scuffling across the crevasse, with the rope swinging, climbing up onto safer ground. When he's upright, it's my turn. The snow sucks at my feet, and I'm floundering with both arms and legs as I ride the back of the deep, struggling for breath. If the snow bridge gave now, I'd surrender with relief, stop fighting upwards and sink into the depths to be free of gravity and regain my breath. Perhaps it's the dichotomy of elation and terror that draws us to the knife edge, but also what keeps people away. My introduction to alpine climbing the previous week certainly had me wondering if summit fever was for me. I began to think that the lure of the summits must be a young person's game, something that my father never had the chance to outgrow. When we are all three across, we don't linger at the Frühstückplatz long, gripped as we are in a cold west-facing dawn. We look up to the shaded snow slope, steepening above a gnarly area of crevasses. This slope defines our next 2 hours of ascent up to the Hügesattel, the saddle from which the more technical part of the climb begins. The pace is crucial. Seemingly ludicrously slow, it has to allow us to keep going for 2 hours without overheating and so exhausting ourselves. Zips can be adjusted, but with a harness on and roped up, clothing changes are impossible. Colin, as ever, sets the perfect pace. But, as ever, I wish I was fitter. I plant the ice axe, lift my left foot through, lift my right leg through. Plant, one, two. Plant, one, two. Every motion is deliberate and moonwalk slow. Each step is hard-earned. There's an absolute focus which knocks away any other thought. "Remember to stand upright," Rick calls. "Don't hug the hill." And he's right. To have weight on the crampons, one needs to be perpendicular to the hill, but it feels like leaning out. I don't look down or think of the potential slide. I look at what's immediately ahead. It's steep and slow, but I can breathe. My moves feel strong, and we are undoubtedly heading for the summit. The Finsteraarhorn, I think. I'm climbing it. A glance over my shoulder reveals a pair of climbers gaining on us. A beard, a pair of rectangular spectacles. New faces. We greet and agree they should pass us. Colin is tiring from all the step cutting, and they're faster than us. Each step on the crest spreads a revelation of new geography. Steep slopes rising in range after range below and beyond, should one dare look. We are walking in the air. I have no sense of time, but Colin has paused ahead.
"What are you thinking, Colin?"
I ask his back. There's a long silence, then I'm knackered. We can see the pair ahead have climbed up onto a prominent block, are having a drink and assessing their way ahead. There seems to be some levelling out, we can't see beyond it, and I wonder if we're nearing the summit. We pause, waiting to see what they'll do next.
"We're going to turn back," a Czech voice calls to us.
"Yes," says Rick behind me, as if they're confirming his own thoughts.
"There's much snow before the summit," comes the call again. "It will take perhaps another hour and a half, and we're concerned at the condition of the snow for the return."
None of us argue. We move up towards the snow crest, cut a small platform on which we can perch three abreast,
crampons bracing us from the drop below, so that the faster pair can pass us. I see how difficult this is going to be. Our journey is only halfway complete. "The only thing that matters," says Rick as we set off again, "is getting down safely. Take your time." And I feel almost overwhelmed with gratitude for this permission. It calms me. And with Colin below me suggesting holds for my hands and feet, I slowly re-find the steps of our ascent backwards. Our feet touch down onto the safe-seeming smooth snow of the Hoogasartl. When we look at watches, we see that the ridge has gripped our minds and bodies for 4 hours. This is what Rick calls mental fasting, the absolute focus of mountaineering that clears all else. Now it releases us to a group hug and photos. Words flow again. We revel in a sense of achievement, but mostly just in the joy of being up here. "How many days do you get like this in a lifetime?" asks Colin. "Perhaps 30, if you're lucky." I've walked alone so much that it strikes me suddenly this sharing is what mountaineering is about. I feel incredibly lucky to have walked the last days fastened in trust to these two men, while following my father's footsteps. None of the three of us seem to feel that we failed to climb the mountain. The postcard my father sent to his parents shows Finsteraarhorn sharp-spiked, seen from Grindelwald, but it carries a wretched rather than a triumphant message. 11th of August, 1952. "Dear Mum and Dad, I am very cross that you have been told about this miserable business before I have had a chance to let you know myself. This is what happened. Three were together on a small rock, and I at the back on the mass of the rock. Suddenly I saw a large boulder falling clear of the slope and shouted. The girl was standing and did not duck quick enough, and the back of her head was smashed, and she died at once. I volunteered to stay for the guides. I look forward to home. Love, Richard." I wonder if it came to haunt him, this place, the miserable business that befell him here. I wonder if my joy now can mend that dark twist in history. A reply comes from the Alpine Club in London. My father was never a member. But they do have a press clipping about the accident that I haven't yet seen. I read, "Woman student killed, Geneva, August the 10th. 4 English alpinists climbing to the Finsteraarhoch on Friday were making for the Strahleg hut when they were overtaken by an avalanche of stones. 1 Miss E. R. Pendleton of Oxford, a student, was struck and killed. The others, who were unhurt, went for help." They were descending when the accident happened, and not descending from Finsteraarhorn, but from Aghazishorn. I am swept to a new conclusion. My father clearly admired Finsteraarhorn, but didn't climb it. His memory beguiled me into a climb far more challenging than I would have chosen myself. After my initial dismay at doing the wrong mountain, I've come to see it as my father's joke on me. I see how unreliable memory is and how buried it becomes, but I know this experience will echo on. A spell has been untied, a story retraced, and given words out of silence.
Dublin Back by Linda Cracknell is abridged by Sean Parise and produced by Gaynor McFarlane.
When the Spanish arrived to conquer the New World, they found the gold that they'd hoped for, but they also found something that they completely had not expected that turned out to be one of the greatest treasures of all.
BBC Radio 4 peers through the pigments of our colour-saturated world.
A little bug upon a cactus.
2 new programmes exploring the history and theory of colour.
The Medici's Room of Wonders is lined with sumptuous red to represent the element of fire and power.
Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen's Primary Colours, this morning at 11.